for entering states of meditative absorption. Because of these different qualities, the breath is used as the basis for the practice of tranquility and insight, shamatha vipassana, dry insight practices, sukha vipassana, and meditative absorptions, jhana. Whenever we refer to the breath as the meditation object, we actually mean the sensations produced by breathing, not some visualization or idea of the breath going in and out. When I direct you to observe the breath in the chest or abdomen, I mean the sensations of movement, pressure, and touch occurring there as you breathe in and out. When I say the breath at the nose, I mean the sensations of temperature, pressure, and air moving on the skin anywhere around the tip of the nose, the rim, inside the nostrils, or on the upper lip just below the nostrils. Throughout the 10 stages, your meditation object will most often be the breath sensations at the nose, but not always. Some suggest using the sensations of rising and falling at the abdomen instead. Beginners often find the large movements of the abdomen easier to follow at first. But when the breath becomes very shallow, the coarser sensitivity of the abdomen can make it harder to detect the breath sensations. I recommend the nose because the nerve endings there are much more sensitive. Choose whatever area around the nostrils works best for you. Even though the breath has many benefits, the methods presented in the 10 stages can also be used with a visualized object, a mantra, or in loving-kindness practices. All the same principles can be employed in conjunction with the noting technique of the Mahasi-style Vipassana method, the breath concentration and body-scanning techniques of the Uba-Kin Goenka Vipassana method, or the uniquely systematic Vipassana of Shinzen Young. In each of these, you face the same problems of mind-wandering, distraction, and dullness, which the techniques here are designed to address. That said, not every meditation object leads to the final stages as surely as do the sensations of the breath. A gradual four-step transition to the meditation object. In this practice, you transition gently from the free-ranging attention of daily life to focusing on the breath at the nose. The transition is spread over four steps. In each, you define a specific domain or space in which you can allow your attention to range freely. Any object in the space can serve as the focus of your attention at any moment, meaning your focus just moves as it will. As you proceed from step to step, you further restrict the space in which attention is free to move, until you're finally focused on the sensations of the breath at the nose. But as you make this transition with attention, remember to always maintain peripheral awareness. Every step in the transition provides a good opportunity to learn to distinguish between attention and awareness. Treat this as a serious practice, not just as a nice way to start a meditation. Use it each time you sit down to meditate, especially if you're a beginner. As you move through these four steps, always remember to relax your body, calm your mind, and deliberately evoke feelings of contentment. It's like gradually settling into a spa. Continually notice any pleasant sensations, contributing to a sense of relaxation, well-being, and overall happiness. As you will learn, relaxation and happiness play an important role in the process of training the mind. Step 1. Focus on the present. First, close your eyes and spend a few moments becoming fully present. Take in everything presented to the senses. With your eyes closed, you'll find the two main sensory stimuli are sounds and sensations originating on or in the body. Open your peripheral awareness fully. Next, allow your attention to tune into and range freely among any of the sounds, bodily sensations, smells, or thoughts you may experience. Within this holistic panorama, the one limitation you place on movements of attention is to remain in the present, here and now. Staying present is extremely important. While noises and bodily sensations all occur in the here and now, thoughts about them, beyond just noticing and recognizing them, take you away from the present. So let your attention go to any sensations that attract it, but don't analyze or think about them. Observe bodily sensations objectively, not identifying with them as mine. Let your attention move as it will, drawn by the moment-to-moment arising and passing away of sensory objects within your field of conscious awareness. If you find a particular sensation to be pleasant, take a moment to enjoy it. Let that pleasure condition your mind toward a state of happiness in the present. Try to distinguish clearly between the subjective quality of pleasure and the sense object that triggered it, savoring the pleasure, not the sense object. If your mind reacts to something unpleasant, distinguish between that reaction and the object that produced it. Then let go of the reaction. You'll also be aware of all kinds of other mental activities, memories, thoughts about the future, or things happening elsewhere, and so on. Expect this kind of activity to go on in your mind. Being fully present means being aware of it, but not engaging in its content. Disregard any thought that has nothing to do with the present moment. Even thoughts about the present should be approached cautiously, because they can quickly drag you away from the here and now. On the other hand, some thoughts, such as how to make your posture more comfortable, can help you settle into the present. In general, mindfully observing thoughts is tricky, so it's better to focus on sounds, smells, and physical sensations to avoid being hooked by thoughts. A helpful phrase to remember when dealing with distractions of any kind is, let it come, let it be, let it go. Don't try to suppress it, just let it come into peripheral awareness. Don't engage the distraction or focus attention on it, simply disregard it and let it be in the background. Then let it go away by itself. This is a passive process. There is nothing to do but allow these objects to arise and pass away on their own, moment by moment. When you find your attention has been captured by a thought, just come back to the present. Step 2. Focus on bodily sensations. Once you've become fully present with every kind of sensory stimulus, limit your attention to bodily sensations. These include all physical sensations arising on or in the body, such as touch, pressure, warmth, coolness, movement, tingling, deep visceral sensations like a rumbling in your stomach, and so forth. With your attention limited to bodily sensations, let everything else slip into the background of peripheral awareness. Nothing should be suppressed or excluded from your field of conscious awareness. Just let sounds, smells, and thoughts keep circulating in the background, but don't focus on them. Let them come, let them be, and let them go in peripheral awareness while you restrict all movements of attention to bodily sensations. Whenever you notice your attention going to a sound or thought, bring it back to the body. As you pay more attention to your body, release any tension you find and make final adjustments to your posture. Again, notice any pleasant sensations, distinguishing between the sensation as sensation and your mind's reaction to it, and spend a few moments enjoying the pleasure. These pleasant sensations might include feelings of air moving over the skin, warmth or coolness, and the softness or supportive firmness of the meditation cushion. You may experience pleasant sensations deeper in your muscles and joints as you relax, or warm feelings in your chest and abdomen. There may simply be an overall pleasant sense of stillness and peace. Whatever the sensations, enjoy and explore them freely. For a beginner, it can be hard to relax at first because your mind is agitated and your body is unaccustomed to staying still for long. When you start feeling restless or your sense of contentment fades, then thoughts, memories, and emotions will begin to stir. Don't get annoyed or try to suppress them. Instead, return to step one, broadening your awareness until you become fully present with everything happening in the moment again. In particular, seek out the pleasurable aspects of the present and try to reestablish and reinforce feelings of contentment and happiness. Repeat this process of backing off and starting over as often as needed until the mind can rest easily with your attention focused only on bodily sensations. There is no need to hurry on to the next step. If you never get past step two during your entire meditation session, that's perfectly fine. However, sometimes focusing in more can also help you settle down, so don't hesitate to try moving to the next step. You can always return to this one if narrowing your focus doesn't work. Step 3. Focus on bodily sensations related to the breath. As you sit quietly observing the body, your attention will naturally gravitate toward the sensations of movement produced by breathing, since little else changes while sitting quietly. As you tune in, start paying attention to all the different kinds of breath-related sensations. You will notice them especially around your nose, face, chest, and abdomen. You may find sensations of movement caused by the breath in your upper arms and shoulders or elsewhere. Take your time to become familiar with all these breath-related sensations. In particular, savor any pleasant qualities associated with them. You may notice the mind becomes mildly invigorated during the in-breath, while the out-breath feels more relaxing and soothing. Without suppressing anything else in your field of conscious awareness, restrict your attention to these breath-related sensations. Once you settle in, start focusing more directly on the sensations of the breath in specific areas. Closely observe the rise and fall of the abdomen, then the expansion and contraction of the chest, then the sensations produced by air moving in and out of the nostrils. Allow your mind to move freely among the abdomen, chest, nose, and anywhere else where you feel breath-related sensations. It's important to breathe naturally. Be a passive observer, noticing any sensations that happen to be present. You don't have to exaggerate the breath to make sensations easier to notice. If you want to perceive them more clearly, try imagining that you're looking at the place where the sensations are occurring. Let your eyes rest in a position that serves your imagination, but don't actually try to direct your eyes to the tip of your nose or your abdomen. That will just create discomfort. Your eyes will naturally tend to rest as though they were looking at a point a few inches in front of your face. Nor should you visualize the area in your mind. Take note of, savor, and even purposely induce feelings of peace and happiness, especially as your attention becomes more stable and you experience more inner calm. Step 4. Focus on sensations of the breath at the nose. Now direct your attention to the sensations produced by the air moving in and out of your nostrils. Locate where those sensations are clearest, just inside the nostrils, at the tip of the nose, on the upper lip, or wherever else. The area may be as small as a pencil eraser or up to 2 inches across. Also, the location of sensations may not be quite the same for the in and out breaths. Keep your attention on the area where the breath sensations are clearest. Don't try to follow the air as it moves into the body or out of your nose. Just observe the sensations from the air passing over the spot where you're focusing your attention. Remember, the meditation object is the sensations of the breath, not the breath itself. Without intentionally suppressing anything from awareness, keep watching the sensations of the in and out breath. If your attention wanders, gently bring it back. And that's it. From this point on, the sensations of the breath at the tip of the nose will be your primary meditation object. Cultivating stable attention will continue all the way through stage 6. Developing exclusive attention is the final event in the process and won't happen before stage 6, so don't even concern yourself with it in the early stages. For now, your aim is just to tame the constant movements of attention, while at the same time trying to maintain peripheral awareness of things in the background. In other words, you want to develop stable attention with mindfulness. Counting as a method to stabilize attention. Counting your breaths at the start of a sit really helps stabilize your attention. If you're a novice, you should use this method all the time. Once you have moved through the four steps and attention is restricted to the breath at the nose, start silently counting each breath. Your goal will be to follow the sensations continuously for 10 consecutive breaths. When your attention slips or you lose track of the count, which will happen frequently at first, just start over again at 1. For now, consider your attention continuous if you've missed neither an inhale nor an exhale nor lost count of your breaths. However, don't expect perfection. For a beginner, you're doing well if you're aware of most of the in-and-out breath. You can set higher standards for yourself as you become more skilled, but in the beginning, high standards are unreasonable and will only discourage you. Also, you won't be able to focus exclusively, single-pointedly, on the breath. In fact, trying to do so will only cause your mind to wander more. So expect to be aware of many other things as you're watching the breath. Finally, you're not trying for nonverbal or non-conceptual observation at this point. You can talk to yourself and think about the breath as much as you like while observing it, as long as you don't completely lose awareness of the actual sensations or lose track of the count. Interestingly, what you consider the start and end of a breath cycle matters. We automatically tend to regard the beginning as the inhale and the pause after the exhale as the end. However, if you're thinking about the breath in that way, then that pause becomes the perfect opportunity for your thoughts to wander off, since the mind naturally tends to shift focus when it has completed a task. Instead, try this. Consider the beginning of the out-breath as the start of the cycle. That way, the pause occurs in the middle of your cycle and is less likely to trip you up. This may seem like a small detail, but it often makes a difference. Another approach is to silently say the number during the pause at the end of the out-breath. This fills the gap and helps keep the mind on task. If you have started over many times without successfully reaching 10, change the goal to 5. Before long, 10 breaths will be easy. Once you've succeeded in counting to 5 or 10, keep observing the breath sensations, but stop counting. Counting quickly becomes automatic, and you can still forget the breath and have your mind wander while continuing to count. Therefore, counting beyond 10 breaths has little value. The rule is never more than 10, never less than 5. However, if your mind is particularly agitated or wanders again soon after you bring it back, do another 10 count when you return to the breath. Also, if your mind wanders for a long time, several minutes or more, once you become aware of it, don't immediately return to the breath at the nose. Rather, go back to step 2 and briefly focus on bodily sensations, then to step 3 and focus on breath sensations in general, and then start counting breaths at the nose. Even if you use a meditation object other than the breath, counting is still a wonderful way to transition from daily activities into a more focused meditative state. Just as with Pavlov's dogs, the mind becomes conditioned over time to counting as a sign to start meditating, and it will automatically calm down. Regardless of whether you're a beginner or an advanced meditator, I strongly recommend using counting as part of your regular practice. Counting will give you valuable information on the state of your mind and the distractions you're most likely to face. When you master stage 10, you will have effortless concentration before reaching the 10th breath. Summary of the basic practice. Sit down, close your eyes, and go through the 6-point preparation for meditation: motivation, goals, expectations, diligence, distractions, and posture. Then do the 4-step transition, gradually restricting the natural movements of your attention as you move from one step to the next. The transition needs to be gentle and gradual. Emphasize relaxation, peacefulness, and pleasure rather than willpower and effort. When you reach step 4 and you're focusing on the breath at the nose, stabilize your attention by counting 5 or 10 breaths without interruption. When you're finished counting, Keep attending to the sensations of the breath at the nose. The time it takes to work through this entire sequence varies from person to person and from one session to the next. For a novice, just moving through the four-step transition may take most or all of the session. As you improve, you will proceed more quickly. Eventually, you will move through the 6 points and from the free-ranging attention of daily life to a stable focus on the meditation object in a matter of minutes or seconds. Establishing a practice. Now that you understand how to begin your practice, we'll focus on the primary goal of stage one, establishing a regular daily practice. This may seem obvious, perhaps trivial, but few meditators, even those professing years of experience, maintain a truly consistent practice regimen. Yet to truly reap the many benefits of meditation, you must master this first stage by overcoming the obstacles and taking the necessary steps. Obstacles to establishing a practice. There are four major obstacles to overcome at this stage: not having enough time to meditate, procrastinating instead of sitting down to practice, reluctance and resistance to actually doing the practice, and doubt about your abilities. Time. Finding time to practice is your initial big challenge. When you first decide to take up meditation, you're naturally eager. Maybe you found inspiration from a book or a lecture. Perhaps you attended a meditation class or have a friend who meditates. At first, sheer enthusiasm helps you find time to practice. Yet, as your early excitement fades, you soon begin to feel the pressure of other demands. We will discuss some practical solutions for overcoming this obstacle, but the most effective antidote is actually quite simple. As you would do with anything else you're committed to, you must make the time to meditate. I don't know anyone who has established a meditation practice in his or her spare time. And besides, for most of us, spare time is rare. If you don't set a regular schedule, you most likely won't meditate. Make your practice a priority. Procrastination. Procrastination is one of the classic problems in meditation. Modern life tends to be busy, full of deadlines, and stressful. Maybe you started meditating to manage your stress better, only to find that practicing is just another demand on your overextended time and energy. When this happens, it's easy to say, "I'll meditate after I take care of such and such," or "I'll have more time to meditate tomorrow." This is why you must make practice a priority. Otherwise, you'll always find something more important to do first. Also, once you've been meditating regularly for a while, the aftereffects will make you more at ease and relaxed. Ironically, you will feel like you have more time, not less. Reluctance and resistance. The reason many turn to meditation is the promise of greater mindfulness and inner peace. However, when you sit down and discover how wild and uncontrollable your mind can be, you may easily get frustrated and conclude that meditation is all work and little reward. This is where reluctance and resistance to practice usually appear. Whereas procrastination keeps us from sitting down, reluctance and resistance lead us to spend our time on the cushion daydreaming, fantasizing, or making plans rather than actually meditating. In other words, you'll do almost anything to avoid what you now think is a boring, difficult, and unsatisfying task. The keys to overcoming reluctance and resistance are inspiration and motivation. When you first start practicing, you'll need to get your inspiration from somewhere else. However, once you start making progress, your own success provides motivation. Self-doubt. We tend to stick with activities we are naturally good at and avoid the ones we struggle with. When you discover you can't control your unruly mind, you may begin doubting your abilities. Maybe I'm different in some way, or just lack self-discipline. Or you might believe you aren't smart or spiritual enough for meditation. It's easy to think some inherent obstacle is holding you back, especially if you start comparing your experiences with what other people seem to be achieving. Yet the real obstacle is self-doubt, which is powerful and can rob you of your enthusiasm and determination to establish a regular practice. Without a regular practice, it will take a long time before you see any real improvement, which will only create more doubt. At the root of self-doubt is the classic hindrance of doubt explained in the second interlude. There you'll also find the explanation for how to deal with doubt. But the basic antidote is simple: trust and perseverance, which requires inspiration and motivation. Creating solutions. The most effective way to overcome both procrastination and reluctance and resistance to practicing is to just do it. Nothing works as quickly or effectively as diligence. The simple act of consistently sitting down and placing your attention on the meditation object day after day is the essential first step from which everything else in the 10 stages flows. Then, once seated, you must train yourself, gently and without self-judgment, to actually meditate rather than engage in some more entertaining mental activity. Notice that I said, train yourself, not force or discipline yourself. Force, guilt, and willpower won't produce a sustainable practice, not least because of the negative emotions they stir up. Training yourself means working on your motivation and intentions until the simple acts of sitting down and meditating follow naturally. Then, you repeat those activities every day until they turn into habits. Once you start practicing regularly, you will be surprised by how quickly meditation becomes easier and more gratifying. Diligence helps start you on your way. But the real solution to these obstacles is learning to enjoy your practice. One simple, powerful way to do that is to intentionally savor all feelings of physical comfort and deliberately cultivate the pleasure that can be found in quietness. Take satisfaction in the fact that you have actually sat down to meditate. That is an accomplishment in itself. Too often, people approach meditation as though they were taking medicine. It tastes bad, but they grin and bear it because it's supposed to be good for them. Instead, make meditation into a pleasurable activity. If you're at ease and happy, you will be more successful than if you're tense and straining. The more you succeed in seeking out the pleasant aspects of meditation, the more motivated you'll be and the more you will look forward to practicing. Everything else will fall into place. Doubt will disappear. You'll be inspired to meditate and can find plenty of time for it. Once you taste the joy and pleasure of practice, procrastination and resistance vanish. You'll look forward to your time on the cushion and guard it as something precious. As you progress to the higher stages, you won't just deliberately cultivate joy. It will eventually become your default state of mind. The practical steps. Along with just doing it and learning to savor your meditations, there are some practical steps to establishing a regular practice. These include choosing a suitable time and place, finding the best posture for you, cultivating the right attitude, and generating strong motivation. Setting a time and place. Ideally, you should meditate at the same time every day. You learn to associate that time with meditation and are less likely to procrastinate because you don't have to decide when to meditate. Choose a period that doesn't conflict with other activities and obligations. You may have to make some adjustments to your daily schedule. If the same time is simply impossible, pick a place in your normal routine, for example, before breakfast or after your regular exercise, that will be the same each day. Having a fixed period, whether set by the clock or your daily routine, is the best way to become consistent. Beginning meditators often forget to take their mental energy and clarity into account when picking a regular time to practice. Choose when you tend to be least agitated or tired. Everyone has their own natural rhythms, but generally the best time is early morning. or at least before 1 p.m. Most people prefer the period shortly after waking up in the morning, but before breakfast, since it's best to avoid meditating right after a meal. Next best is late afternoon or early evening. Early to mid-afternoon is often the hardest. The easiest way to make time for practice is by getting up a little earlier. You will feel refreshed and alert, and family and friends will be less likely to disturb you. Also, your mind won't be agitated by the stress and activity of daily life. Of course, getting up earlier only works if you go to bed earlier. No matter what time of day you choose, you'll have to make adjustments in other parts of your life to keep your commitment to practicing. It's an inescapable fact that the time you spend meditating is time you could have used for something else. If you don't make meditation a priority over some other activities, it just won't happen. Begin with shorter meditations. I suggest 15 or 20 minutes each day for the first week or two. Then increase the length of your sessions in 5-minute increments weekly or every few days until you reach 45 minutes. Use a meditation timer rather than looking at a clock, and train yourself not to look at the timer. Just listen for the bell. Some people find it easier to do 2 shorter meditations of 20 to 30 minutes each day. This is fine at first, but I strongly recommend at least 1 daily 45-minute sit as a minimum. This will provide a solid basis for your practice. As you advance through the stages and gain more skill, your meditations will become more interesting and enjoyable. You will eventually have no problem extending 45 minutes into an hour and practicing more than once a day if you choose. It's always best to work up gradually rather than do too much at first and become discouraged. Once you have chosen a schedule, treat meditation like any other time-related commitment, such as work or school. Spend the designated period meditating and do nothing else. Make sure others know you will be unavailable at that time of day. To start with, you may encounter some resistance from your family or anyone not used to you being unavailable, but they will learn to adjust and may even decide to join you in practicing, especially when they start to notice the results of your practice. Most importantly, remind yourself that meditation time is your time, which you have set aside for yourself, a time free from the demands of the world. Considering how much meditation will improve your relationships with others, you shouldn't regard it as selfish. This personal time will ultimately benefit everyone you come in contact with. Also, if possible, practice with someone else. His or her commitment will reinforce yours, and vice versa. However, if you have clearly established your intention, but your practice partner hasn't, it's better to end the practice arrangement. Meditation groups provide especially strong support, but usually don't meet every day. Finally, creating a regular place for meditation is just as important as setting a regular time. Choose a comfortable space where you won't be disturbed. It should be quiet and secluded enough to feel like your special meditation spot. The ideal situation is to have a place just for meditating. However, if that's not possible, it can also be a space you use for other things when you're done. But it should be a place where you can keep your meditation cushions, a shawl, or anything else you might use. Design and decorate it in ways that inspire you and remind you of why you're meditating and what you hope to gain. Some people like to set up an altar as well. It doesn't matter if it's religious or not. Its purpose is to inspire and motivate you in your practice. The right posture. Any comfortable position works for meditation, as long as it's not so comfy that you fall asleep. There are 4 traditional meditation postures: sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. They all work, and none is more correct than the others. Here, we'll focus on some pointers to help you find a good sitting position. You can meditate sitting in a chair, on a meditation bench, or on the floor. Full lotus position, legs crossed with your feet on top of your knees, provides a very stable position and helps keep you alert, but it's not necessary for success. Also, if you aren't flexible enough to sit in full lotus easily, it can cause serious injury. The half lotus position, with legs crossed and only one foot on top of the opposite knee, is likewise very stable. Yet it, too, is not easy for many adult Westerners. The most popular meditation posture is probably sitting on the floor on a zafu, a Japanese-style round cushion, legs crossed, with ankles slightly tucked under the opposite thigh or knee. Alternatively, both knees and lower legs can be flat on the floor, one in front of the other, the so-called Burmese style. Low Japanese-style meditation benches, called seiza, are often used. If sitting on the floor proves difficult, then sit on a regular straight-backed chair. Experiment with different postures before deciding which you prefer. Also, there are many ways to fine-tune any position using pads and pillows, lumbar supports, meditation belts, or straps, height adjustments, and so on. Regardless of the position you choose, it's important there be as little physical strain or pain as possible, especially during longer sits. Expect some aches and pains merely from staying still, but try to minimize pain in general and don't aggravate pre-existing injuries. Regard the discomforts that remain as part of your practice. By observing them, you'll learn how your body and mind interact. And be patient. As your practice develops, it will get easier to sit. Eventually, you will be able to sit for hours without any discomfort. You'll even get up feeling quite good, without any stiffness or numbness. Remain as still as you can during sitting meditation, despite any discomfort. This can be challenging for a beginner, but always wait as long as you can before moving. Then, don't stop meditating when you change position, but rather move slowly and deliberately, with full attention to the sensations in your body as you shift. You will likely discover that although whatever caused you to move in the first place has disappeared, another irritating sensation, possibly more intense, soon takes its place. You simply can't overcome all physical discomfort by adjusting your posture. The right attitude. To succeed, we need to approach the practice in a relaxed manner, free from judgment and expectations. Although we may start out this way, we can quickly slip into a critical, striving attitude when faced with problems such as mind-wandering, sleepiness, and impatience. This attitude becomes the greatest impediment to our continued progress. When words like struggle or difficult come to mind, or if you feel like you're trying really hard but not making any progress, you'll know it's time to examine your attitude. Meditation is a series of simple tasks, easy to perform, that only need to be repeated until they bear fruit. So where is the sense of difficulty and exertion coming from? We usually describe a task as difficult because we're dissatisfied with our performance, which means we've started judging. Your expectations haven't been met, and maybe you're starting to doubt whether you'll ever succeed, which can sap your motivation. You're not actually struggling with meditating. You're struggling with unrealistic expectations and an idealized image of what you think should be happening. As a result, it feels like you're forcing yourself to do something you think you aren't very good at. If you believe those feelings, the ego self naturally wants to avoid blame. If you can convince yourself that you've been trying really hard, then the ego self doesn't feel guilty for not meeting its own self-imposed expectations. You can blame the teacher, the method, or concoct a story about how meditation isn't right for you. The real issue isn't that meditation takes too much effort or that something is innately wrong with you. It's your judgment and expectations. So let go of expectations and generate an attitude of faith, trust, and confidence. Faith in the method, trust that the results will come with continued practice, and confidence in your own ability. Joyful effort and diligence are the right attitude. Rather than striving, focus on the positive, pleasant elements of each session, joyfully repeating the same simple tasks as many times as needed to achieve the goal. This is precisely what diligence means. With spiritual practice in general, and meditation in particular, small measures repeated consistently produce huge results. The only place for great effort in meditation is in adjusting your schedule to actually spend more time practicing. Realize there are no failures in meditation except for actually failing to do the practice. As fellow teacher Stephanie Nash is fond of saying, a good meditation is one you did. The only bad meditation is one you didn't do. Take her wise advice to heart. Staying motivated. You wouldn't be hearing this right now if you weren't somehow inspired to explore meditation. Keep yourself inspired and find new sources of encouragement. Make a point of frequently reminding yourself why you decided to meditate and what the benefits are. Reflect on the admirable qualities of experienced meditators you know. Read books, go to lectures, and listen to recorded talks. Think about how you and everyone around you will benefit from your practice. Do all you can to stay motivated, just as you would if beginning an exercise program or learning to play an instrument. Also, support and inspire others, and let them support and inspire you. Practice with friends who share your interest in meditation, and set aside one day each week to get together for sitting, study, and discussion. Look into local meditation and Dharma groups, or start your own. As the Buddha once told his disciple Ananda, noble friends and companions are the whole of the holy life. When you feel you're ready to try more intensive practice, attend an organized retreat. Conclusion. You have mastered stage one when you never miss a daily practice session, except when absolutely unavoidable, and when you rarely, if ever, procrastinate on the cushion by thinking and planning or doing something besides meditating. This stage is the most difficult to master, but it can be done in a few weeks. By following the basic instructions and cultivating the right attitude, you will develop joyful effort and diligence and establish a regular daily practice. The time and effort put into mastering this stage will pay off far beyond anything you can imagine. Here, monks, a monk goes to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty place, sits down, folds his legs crosswise, keeps his body erect, and brings mindful awareness to the fore. With mindfulness, he breathes in. With mindfulness, he breathes out. Anapanasati Sutta. Second Interlude. The Hindrances and Problems. All the mental skills needed in meditation are innate abilities we can selectively choose to cultivate. It's no different from acquiring any new skill, whether learning a science, a musical instrument, or how to throw a frisbee. We're actually just training ourselves in a way that favors certain inherent abilities over others. Think of meditation as mental training that exercises certain mental muscles so they respond more easily and better serve your needs. Just as the mental capacities we develop and use in meditation are completely natural and normal, so too are those activities of mind that can hinder or even defeat our practice. Traditional meditation literature identifies 5 specific hindrances to overcome before we can make real progress, and understanding them will prove invaluable. In daily life, these so-called hindrances actually serve necessary and useful purposes. Once you're familiar with them and how they work, it becomes obvious that neither suppression nor self-punishment will help you surmount such established and often helpful conditioning. On the other hand, positive reinforcements of other natural tendencies of the mind that oppose these hindrances works very well. Remember, everybody faces these challenges. They're not unique to you, and they're not personal shortcomings. More importantly, and very fortunately, these hindrances are well understood, and there are effective methods for resolving each and every one of them. The 5 Hindrances. We can trace almost every problem in meditation to one or more of five innate and universal psychological predispositions known as the five hindrances: worldly desire, aversion, laziness and lethargy, agitation due to worry and remorse, and doubt. They are called hindrances because they hinder efforts at meditating and create all kinds of problems in daily life as well. Therefore, as countless meditation manuals recognize, learning about them at the start is crucial. Even though these innate predispositions cause problems, we have them precisely because they were useful to our species as we evolved. The first step toward working with the hindrances skillfully is to understand the purposes they ordinarily serve. Second, you will cultivate five meditation factors: directed attention, sustained attention, meditative joy, pleasure, happiness, and unification of mind. Each of these acts as an antidote to one or more of the hindrances and contributes to a key goal of meditation: purifying the mind of these powerful facets of our biological programming and of their negative influences. We discuss the five meditation factors in depth later in the book. Make no mistake, overcoming these hindrances won't deprive you of the ability to survive and care for yourself. In fact, it's just the opposite. We have evolved other abilities, such as intelligence and cooperation, which fulfill the same needs more effectively and with fewer problems. As you stop relying on this once useful but now outdated programming, you will be more fully awake, better able to make clear-headed decisions, and take the appropriate actions. You will also come to realize that these hindrances are the basis for the stories and melodramas the mind concocts. Examples of stories rooted in worldly desire include "I need a beautiful house" and "I want a successful career so I can be happy." Examples of stories rooted in aversion include "I hate rude people," "It's not fair that they always get what they want," "I don't want to be sick today," or "I can't take this place anymore." Examples of stories arising from laziness and lethargy include "I'm too tired to help you right now," and "It's too late," or "A waste of time to try to finish that project." Examples of stories tied to the agitation due to worry and remorse include "What if I get caught?" "I'm ashamed of behaving that way," and "I'm afraid." There are also self-defeating stories steeped in doubt, such as "I can't meditate," "I'm too clumsy to play," and "I'm not good enough, smart enough, fast enough," and so on. These are the stories that largely define our lives. But through meditation, we can question and eventually move beyond the narratives that hold us back. Familiarize yourself with the hindrances and their antidotes and learn to recognize them, not only in meditation, but in daily life as well. Your effort will pay off. 1. Worldly desire. Worldly desire, sometimes called sense desire, is when we pursue, delight in, and cling to the pleasures of material existence. This also means desiring to avoid their opposites. These desires include gaining material objects and preventing their loss, having pleasurable experiences and avoiding pain, achieving fame, power, and influence while avoiding infamy and impotence, and attaining the love and admiration of others while avoiding hatred and blame. In Buddhism, these are sometimes referred to as the 8 worldly dharmas. Here's an easy formula to help you remember them: gain, loss, pleasure, pain, fame, obscurity, and praise, blame. This kind of desire is so fundamental a part of our biological programming that you may have never asked yourself why it exists, or questioned the effects it has, and whether you'd be better off without it. Worldly desire evolved because in the natural world, we have to strive for the resources we need to survive and reproduce, and that takes effort and motivation. We're programmed from birth to take pleasure in, desire, and pursue the very things and experiences that help us stay healthy, get a mate, and provide for our offspring. And we're social animals, so we take pleasure in and crave acceptance, status, and power, because they're important to our survival and reproduction as well. The innate predisposition to desire whatever brings pleasure has made humans very successful. Yet when it comes to the effects of desire on your life, consider that the world has changed since these desires first evolved. Sex, food, especially high-calorie, fatty, sugary, and salty foods, and labor-saving devices are far more available today. Unrestrained desire leads not only to overconsumption and health and relationship difficulties, but many other issues that get revealed through meditation as well. That said, meditation doesn't involve repressing worldly desires. It gives us direct, experiential insight into the many ways that desire leads to pain and anxiety. This insight frees us from being ruled by desire, so we can cultivate its opposite instead, non-grasping and equanimity. Our new motivations will come from a place of generosity, loving-kindness, and shared joy. We will discuss these positive qualities in later chapters. Worldly desire is so deeply embedded in us that you may have trouble imagining how we could live without it. However, as intelligent beings, we no longer need to be driven by compulsive desire in order to take care of ourselves. We can act effectively from a foundation of reason and equanimity. Furthermore, generosity, loving-kindness, and sympathetic joy will only serve to enhance the survival of social beings like ourselves. Nor does eliminating desire lessen our experience of pleasure and happiness. Free from craving and filled with love, we become more fully present for positive experiences of every kind. The practices in this book will make you more aware of desire and give you many opportunities to practice abandoning it. Unification of mind is the meditation factor that specifically opposes and is opposed by the hindrance of worldly desire. As the mind becomes unified, worldly desire weakens and eventually disappears, not only during meditation, but from daily life as well. Experienced firsthand, this is an extraordinary transformation. You don't grow stoic, indifferent to pleasure, or lose your motivation, but rather are filled with joy, calm, and contentment. A unified and blissful mind, in other words, has no reason to chase worldly desires. You will live a more dynamic life, not constrained by craving, and you will be open to many more possibilities. 2. Aversion. Aversion, sometimes called ill will, is a negative mental state involving resistance. Its most extreme form is hatred, with the intent to harm or destroy. But any compulsion to get rid of or avoid unpleasantness, no matter how subtle, is aversion. Dissatisfaction and resentment, most forms of criticism, and even self-accusation, impatience, and boredom are forms of aversion. As with the other hindrances, aversion has been helpful for human survival. In the same way that we're programmed to take pleasure in and desire anything that supports our continued existence, we're programmed to experience displeasure and aversion toward what is potentially harmful. Aversion motivates us to avoid or eliminate what is unpleasant. Aversion hinders meditation in several ways. For instance, thoughts about someone we don't like, a dreaded future obligation, or regrets about the past easily become distractions during meditation. Judgment and impatience about our practice undermine our motivation and encourage doubt. In the later stages, subtle, unconscious traces of aversion can keep mental and physical pliancy from developing and prevent the meditation factor of pleasure, happiness, from arising. Just as aversion opposes mental happiness and physical pleasure, the meditation factor of pleasure, happiness, opposes aversion. Pleasure, happiness counters aversion by making negative states of mind impossible to hold on to, although they can return full force afterward. Simply put, there's little, if any, room for negativity in a mind filled with bliss. This is one of the reasons it's crucial to always seek out pleasurable feelings and encourage positive mental states during practice. You will learn to recognize aversion, replacing it with equanimity, acceptance, and patience. As these become your new predispositions, anger, cold-heartedness, and harmfulness are replaced by loving-kindness, compassion, and harmlessness. You'll be astonished at the profound transformation as aversion disappears from your daily life. 3. Laziness and lethargy. Laziness mostly appears as procrastination. Its counterpart, lethargy, is a tendency toward inactivity, rest, and ultimately sleep. Both involve a lack of energy. Each causes different problems, but together they form a powerful hindrance. When we lack motivation, laziness and lethargy arise and keep us from making enough effort. Laziness is being resistant to doing some particular activity. Laziness is usually thought of as something negative, but it serves a purpose. It keeps us from spending time and energy on unnecessary, unproductive, or unpleasant activities. That time and energy can then be used for activities that contribute to happiness, survival, and reproductive success. Laziness also motivates us to use our skills and intelligence to come up with easier ways of doing things. Laziness arises when the cost of an activity seems to outweigh the benefits. Lethargy arises when there appears to be nothing interesting, exciting, or potentially rewarding going on. This also serves a purpose. Our body and mind need time to rest and recuperate. Rest is a better use of time than engaging in unproductive activities. Like laziness, lethargy is an evolutionary adaptation for conserving time and energy. The essence of lethargy is a progressive, involuntary loss of mental energy. The longer it continues, the harder it is to halt this downward slide. There are two antidotes for laziness and lethargy. The first is to motivate yourself by thinking about future rewards. This means weighing the costs against the benefits in a rational and intelligent way, rather than just trusting your emotions. For instance, whenever you have trouble bringing yourself to meditate, you can recall all the benefits that will come if you keep practicing. So, to deal with laziness, you need to muster enough motivation to actually begin the task you want to complete. Dealing with lethargy means having enough motivation to complete the task, rather than quitting or falling asleep. The second antidote is to just do it. This means that you plunge in, despite resistance, and then engage with the task fully. This works well against laziness because the power of laziness lies in procrastination. Before we start an activity, we can question its value and suggest alternatives that seem more appealing. Laziness makes it hard to start a task, but once we start, it's easier to continue. If we get interrupted, though, laziness can return and make restarting difficult. In any case, since laziness often fades when we begin a task, just doing the task is the antidote. Engaging fully with a task also works against lethargy by re-energizing the mind. But how effective this is depends on how quickly we recognize the onset of lethargy. The meditation factor of directed attention opposes laziness and lethargy, and vice versa. This hindrance impedes directed attention because we cannot easily direct a dull, tired, and unmotivated mind. In meditation, just doing it means you keep directing attention to the meditation object, countering procrastination and any loss of mental energy. Eventually, directed attention becomes powerful and automatic enough to completely overcome laziness and lethargy. 4. Agitation due to worry and remorse. We feel this kind of agitation when we're conflicted about the past or concerned about the future. This agitation can take the form of remorse for past unwise, unwholesome, or immoral activities, or for something we neglected to do. We may also have agitation due to remorse when fretting about the possible consequences. For example, you may feel remorse about an affair, either because of the pain your spouse would feel if he or she found out, or because of your own guilty conscience. Another form of this agitation to take is worry. Yes, we worry about the consequences of unwholesome actions, but we also worry about neutral actions. For instance, you may worry about whether or not you locked the back door. Even wholesome activities can cause anxiety. Perhaps you drove your friend to the hospital because she had the flu, but now you worry that you may have caught it. And once you start worrying, it often leads to more agitation as you wonder about how you might prevent or cope with the consequences of your imaginary scenarios. We also worry about very unlikely things, such as being caught in a terrorist attack. We can create endless combinations of worry and remorse for ourselves, all of which make us more agitated. Our predisposition to agitation due to worry and remorse helps spur us to correct things when possible, to protect ourselves when confronted by unavoidable consequences, and to prepare as best we can for an uncertain future. The mental discomfort also helps discourage us from creating similar situations in the future. However, if we can't put our agitated energy to good use, it makes us stressed because of our unresolved impulses to act. It also makes it harder to focus on anything else. Even when we consciously set aside or unconsciously repress worry and remorse, the mind remains agitated, affecting our body and emotions. Most of us are quite aware of the adverse effects of such stress. Yet in meditation, we discover directly how even negative actions from the distant past and long-forgotten worries can still produce agitation. They're like seeds buried in the unconscious furrows of the mind. Only when we become quiet enough can they emerge fully into the light of consciousness. Our past shapes our current perceptions and behaviors, and unresolved issues can stand in the way of peace of mind, joy, and happiness in the present. The best antidote to this kind of agitation is to take up the practice of virtue. When we behave virtuously, we don't create further causes for remorse or worry. But what is virtue? I don't mean morality in the sense of adhering to an external standard demanded by a deity or other authority, nor do I mean ethics, as in following a system of rules that prescribe the best way to act. Both moral principles and ethical codes can be followed blindly without necessarily having to resolve your own bad mental habits. Rather, virtue is the practice of inner purification, which results in good behavior. If you think of the mind as an engine, the practice of virtue allows for the smoothest, most powerful performance. Likewise, every action that has an unskillful intent, even the most subtle, is like a small bit of grit reducing the mind's performance. As a virtuous person, you'll enjoy a peace of mind that enables you to reach the highest stages of meditation. Of course, there are many other benefits to being virtuous, but the practice of virtue is intrinsically rewarding. While training in virtue helps prevent misconduct in the future, the other remedy is doing whatever's possible to resolve any existing sources of worry or remorse by taking positive action. After you've done what you can, you must forgive yourself and seek forgiveness of others for what can't be resolved. Then, let go once and for all of these events and any judgments about them. A deep purification of the mind happens in meditation, and a large part of that purification involves putting to rest concerns about past misconduct, actual or perceived. Agitation due to worry and remorse is a specific state of mind. The meditation factor of meditative joy is also a state of mind. Since the two are opposites, they cannot exist together. The continued presence of this agitation interferes with the arising of meditative joy. Similarly, as the mind becomes more joyful with continued practice, agitation due to worry and remorse dies down. Joy overcomes worry because it produces confidence, optimism, and the certainty one can handle whatever challenges life may present. Likewise, joy overcomes remorse because a joyful person sincerely regrets any harm he or she has caused in the past and is eager to set things right. 5. Doubt. Doubt is healthy and valuable when it motivates us to question, investigate, and try things for ourselves. It keeps us from blindly accepting what others say or what seems true, and from being misled and taken advantage of. As a survival strategy, it keeps us from wasting our time and resources. Doubt begins as an unconscious mental process that focuses on negative results and negative possible outcomes. Once the mind decides a situation should be examined more closely, the emotion of doubt becomes part of conscious experience. If the feeling of doubt is strong enough, it compels us either to reevaluate an activity or to abandon it altogether. The purpose of doubt is simply to challenge the strength of our motivation, inviting us to test our current activities and intentions with reason and logic. Doubt becomes a hindrance if, instead of reevaluating the situation rationally, we respond only to the emotional uncertainty it creates. Too often, that keeps us from making the effort needed to validate something through our own experience. We can never succeed at any difficult task if we simply abandon whatever makes us uncertain. Doubt in this form is more like a perverse faith in failure that saps our will and undermines our intentions. For example, if you doubt your ability to succeed in meditation, your motivation will fade and you won't sit down to practice. The remedy for doubt is to use our reasoning abilities to envision the possibility of long-term success, countering the short-term emotional pressure of this hindrance. Once we've overcome the paralyzing effects of doubt, we can move forward with stronger motivation and, through action, achieve certainty. The ultimate remedy for doubt is the trust and confidence that come from success, and success depends on persistent effort. Although doubt is often projected onto other people and things, it often takes the form of self-doubt, a lack of confidence in our own abilities. Of the many forms doubt takes, self-doubt is so pervasive that it's worth addressing specifically and providing a few more assurances and antidotes. If you doubt your ability to concentrate, just remember that even though some people are calmer by nature than others, very few have such active minds that they cannot meditate. Even serious cases of attention deficit disorder don't prevent people from achieving the highest goals of meditation. If your mind is really more active than average, the first three stages will be the most challenging. But rest assured, not only can you master them, but the stages after will come much more easily. For some, self-doubt is about self-esteem, specifically about comparing yourself to others you believe are brighter or more capable.